Okay, great. I'm glad we have a huge audience here. And some of you have seen some of these things, what I'm going to talk about before, but maybe I'll give a different slant on it and show you some of the processes that you saw when we had our NSCSS trip out at Sid Davis's vernal pools. And maybe a little bit of an explanation of how he got to where he was and what we're doing in another consulting firm. So, and I also want to kind of bring up about the value of the use of a soil scientist and his knowledge, his or her knowledge, that it either can cost you big bucks or it can save you lots of money. And I'll give you some dollar figures, a couple of them later on. So this is one of the pools that we had constructed, and I'll go you through some processes of how we got to this point. a little bit about an introduction, and then where a lot of these vernal pools are being constructed, the landscape and soils, the soil and design process, and how soil scientists are used to identify the soil properties which are necessary for a good vernal pool construction for mitigating purposes, the construction process and how soil scientists are used during the construction process, and the results. So this area is located, most of the vernal pools are on very old landscapes, but I'll show you in a minute, but it's on mostly the a lot of them occur on the east side of the Sacramento Valley. Our project site that we're going to be talking about is right here, but we also had another one in this area, which I'll show you some pictures as well. And we had another one right up here as well, which I'll show you pictures. So most of it is in the near the Sacramento area. This is a schematic that's out of the Sacramento Soil Survey report, and it shows that from this point right here all the way out to this point is an area which may be old enough to have certain soil properties that will restrict water penetration. And these are mostly, there are Dury Xeralfs or Paley Xeralfs. And these are low terraces right here, and these are the higher terraces, and we're talking about 50 to maybe 100,000 to these, and this, or maybe even up to 500,000 years. They've done studies on when the magnetic change occurred about 700,000 years ago, and these are less than that, so we know that it can go up to that age. And then, here it is. And then these are the higher terraces where we have both durapans and a dense clay layers, which in depressions will pond water. Also, in a little bit of these areas right here, you have very dense clay soils, which are vertisols, which also can support in depressions vernal pools. And I'll show you that in a minute. This is a schematic showing what a natural landscape looks like, that you have these upland areas and with a loam or silt loam surface about a foot, 12 to 24 inches thick, and then you'll have a dense, abrupt clay pan, and then underneath that you'll have a silica cemented durapan. This layer here can vary in thickness from just a few inches thick, the clay pan, to 2 or 3 feet thick, and the same on the durapan can be as much as just a thin sheet of paper to several feet thick. Typically, even though if the durapan is not very thick, the cemented layer below it also is dense enough and restricted enough to hold water. This is a quick diagram showing you the profile description. And this is a schematic showing what a reconstructed soil profile would kind of look like. you take the material from the pool and it's either taken off-site or very gently scattered around the edge of the pool. And so then now you have a anthropogenic soil where time zero starts over. These slopes are a little bit exaggerated in this drawing. 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 slopes are common for building the vernal pools. And then we have in the bottom, we have an inoculant which we apply, and I'll show you that. So the whole process is to excavate down to this limiting layer, either the clay pan or the durapan. So this is a natural unaltered soil, the San Joaquin soil. It's a abruptic durizeralf, and in fact it's our state soil. You can see here, this is it's in inches, and this is an abrupt clay, abrupt boundary to the clay pan, and the durapan is right here, and that's about as far as we could dig with the backhoe. So, and I talked to you about the, in some basins, in the high terraces and low terraces, you can get some basins which are vertisols. They're cracking, but what they happen is water will come and fall and start sealing up from the bottom, and then they'll also seal from the top. One of the biggest areas right southwest of Sacramento, Jepson Prairie, is actually mostly on vertisols, and it's about a 2 or 3 acre pond. It's quite floristic in the summertime, and these clays are 55 to 65 or even sometimes higher percent clay. So I don't dig things by hand anymore. If they want me to do it by hand, I tell them to go get somebody else. Like you've mentioned, ask. Well, I ask for a backhoe, and that's what I use now. And I've dug hundreds and almost 1,000 of these things with this, and I get pretty proficient. Beside, boys and their toys are kind of fun. I'm going to talk just about this first part here on this slide, and I'll come back to the right slide later. To begin with, the consulting firm that I work for the developer, of course, the whole thing is process is that they're going to develop some land and housing, and they're going to destroy some wetlands. So now they got to mitigate and build some. And so the developer wants to know, well, where can I go find property to build these soils, to build these vernal pools or these wetlands? So this consulting firm I work for, they hire me and they say, go do an exploratory feasibility study. Can we go out there and is the land soil properties, can we build on that? So I do in this particular project, about 700 acres. And this piece here is about 200 acres, 80 hectares. So I did about a 40, almost 50 pit exploratory survey just to start with. And it kind of big bucks writing, you can turn down a sale by saying, I'm sorry, you only got 10 acres out of the 200 that are available for vernal pools. Or you can say, yeah, I think about 80% of the area would be available to go ahead, and it has the right properties to restrict water. So it's kind of, it's a little bit of apprehensive showing you, if you make a mistake, it's a pretty big mistake. So right off the bat, then I give them an idea of what some cuts and fills might be. And so we start examining some of these soils, and I'll show you the variability that may occur in a particular project, that if you happen to plan or design a pool in a certain spot and it doesn't work, you're talking about $20,000 to $40,000 just in this one area. Just for one pool. So to show some differences, here's a little bit of movement on the surface. The clay pan is right here, and the durapan is right here, but there's been some alteration in the surface. Well, that's not too bad. If you cut right to this clay pan, you can see that you don't need much of a cut right here. And this, by leaving this clayey layer, then that's all you need. The water will pond on top of that clay layer. In the other cases, you may have a clayey surface, but if you dig down maybe a foot to 2 feet, or even, yeah, by 2 feet, this is now opening up and it's become clay loam to clay textures. If you build it here and had a 2 foot cut or even a foot cut, you're going to have a failure in this particular area. And then again, in some places, we worked in this, in one project here, a lot of these pictures are in the area which was a natural landscape. It had mound, inner mound, it had vernal pools and swales in it, and they leveled it for a pasture. And even with good photography, and I'll show you in a little bit, you can't tell where these places are that were. We even went back to find some 1937 photography to see where these swales or ponds were, and today you can't tell. And so you could a little bit in one place is on a major swale. So here, this is fill, F-I-L-L, and you can see the old buried surface right here. So this was a drainage way, a swale. And this site, particular site, there'd be just too much cut in order to have a good, cost too much to build one right here. In fact, here's another one at 5 feet where it was a deep swale, and now you're over an old buried A horizon down that was a deep drain at some place. And again, here you can see that this is partial fill, another type of fill over another buried horizon. So these different soil conditions, what I do is I do not a detailed profile description, because I know it's a single use, and a lot of times that's not a good idea. But when you're kind of under pressure to get something done quickly, identify the right properties of what they're looking for. So you can see here in this leveled pasture, you can't tell that in that site right there whether there's a clay pan or a hard pan, or it's deep to a swale. So you need enough examinations in order for them to go ahead with the design process. Again, here is a little bit of fill where they scrape some of that clay material over an existing soil, and there's no durapan or clay pan in this particular site. We also looked in some upland areas right off to the adjacent side of it, which showed that here is a soil that was undisturbed. This is the surface soil, because loams. This is the clay, dense clay, and they averaged percentage of clay about 35 to maybe 55% clay in places. And then you have a durapan, which is right here, and it really difficult. It took me about 20 minutes just to go from here to here. So it's some of that really cemented. And these really make good sites, because all you need to do is scrape a little bit, pile up a little bit on the side, and you have a nice hard surface ponded. Now this one was cut into what was a good clay pan soil, and the clay pan is right here. So now the surface soil is gone, and you almost don't need to scrape anything at all in this particular site. So, and this is just in the exploratory process. So all these different conditions I found in my feasibility studies, well, there are some places that are good, some places that are not. And normally these colors are kind of brown colors, but there are other soils out there, and this is also a clay pan right here. In fact, it is a durapan. This is a Dura-Zeralf. And by excavating just about to the clay pan would make a really good limiting layer. And so these are some of the pits that we dug. Some pit times we dig only one pit in an area, or sometimes we dig three or four pits in an area, just depending on the size of the pool and the variability of the of the landscape. Now back again to the same slide in the design. Well, let me go ahead a little bit. I just wonder what. Okay, I'll go back to the other one. Then what they did is they did some GPS, and actually these are the exact pools in which they're going to destroy on the development project. And this is, these are the design pools. So I'll come back to this slide in a minute. So what I did then is in the designed areas where they had pools designed, I dug a pit in every pool and sometimes two or three pits in every pool. We built about 326 pools, and I dug about 311 pits. And so some of them, I'll show you in a little bit later, I denied or turned down, said, no, don't dig it here because we don't have the right soil properties. And others, I moved just a part of the boundary. And others, to compensate for those that I turned down, I would say, okay, let's build a new one in an area they hadn't designed one. So, and what cost are we talking about here? This project is about $1,250,000, $20,000 to $40,000 per acre. And so we're not, you're talking about lots of money and making the right kind of decision. To get the right density for their design purpose, what this project did is they went to three separate areas and they looked at the concentration or the density of the vernal pools. And in it varied anywhere from, in one area, about 30% of the area. This is natural, unaltered areas. And this is about 14%. And this one is about 10%. So what they did is they designed, in this project area, they went from about 10 to 30%, depending on the size of the area which you looked at. In this project area, I want to show you, let's see, is this the one? I'll come back to that later. So what we do is we take laser levels. You can just barely see there are stakes out here in the field. And the design, the fields are staked out. The shape of the pool is staked out. In another project we had, they actually had a receiver on a pickup. He had a GIS map on here with an arrow. He had a spray paint can on the edge of his pickup, and he'd drive to the site where his arrow was on the edge of the pool. He'd drive around the edge of the pool, spraying the edge of the pool, which made it really easy for me to know where the edge of the pool and what pool I was in. And I thought that was pretty cool. And so then we had laser levels marking where our low point was on the pool for the spillway and the edges of the pool in relation to, we wanted about an average of a 12-foot or 12-inch pond depth. And so then you're out here during the construction process with graders with laser levels on them to get the right grade, and you're really busy during this particular time when you have two or three or four graders going, backhoes or excavators, bulldozers going, graders going, all going and trying to weave in and out of all these different places, trying to stay in some places away from wetlands and keep the tractors off of wetlands that have been identified, and then also designing your, building your pit. And of course, a lot of the backhoe or earth movers like to go in nice circles, and vernal pools are more irregular polygons. These particular, in this project, This tractor here was 1,400 horsepower, engine in the front, engine in the back. This one is 14, and yet 2,800 horsepower when they're tandem pulling this thing. And when they weren't doing what I want them to do, I would stop them. And here I am talking over here, and the foreman would come running over. What the heck are you doing? I said, well, I need to tell them what to do and not to do. He said, don't do that. If they stop 1 minute, it costs me $160, even just to take a pee. Oh, sorry. So there's conflicts between them getting their time in and costing money and me telling them, hey, stop, you're not doing what I want you to do to fit the design of the pool. So it's like Pierre says, it's a touch and go situation of what you're going to agree on to do. Then you have tractors with dozers, and they're ripping up the area, marking the edge of the boundary so the big graders can come in and design the thing. Graders coming and going back and forth, and you're out there trying with your cut and fill sheet saying, hey, we got a 16-inch cut, but the clay pan's coming in at 10 inches. Stop. And they said, well, you said to cut 16. Yeah, but soils aren't always uniform, and you got to do it on the fly. The initial test with the backhoe pit for each pit doesn't give you the complete 100% of what that particular pool bottom or the soil landscape is going to do. So you're out there monitoring 100% of the time to get the best project going. And it's a rush trying to get them to do what you want them to do. Here, the backhoe, again, the grader, sometimes the ground is so hard that the earth movers can't scrape very well, so they get and run the chisel. The chisels go too deep, and then they dig up big clods of stuff which you don't want them to dig up. So it's a good process. Anyway, getting nearer the finish, this grader is starting to do the side slopes at the right grade with laser level. Where's my marker? There it is. Laser levels right here on the grader. The grader then can follow a certain landscape. Getting closer to the end with this tractor, he's got a Gannon box in the back, and so he can start smoothing out, taking the big ruts and things out, smoothing the bottoms. And you're constantly checking, did they dig deep enough? Did they do overcut or undercut? On a pretty much completed pool now, they've scraped it down to about where we want them to cut to, but we're not finished. What they do is during the project site where they are destroying the pools, they go in and take 2 to 4 to 6 inches of the particular seed source, so they have fairy shrimp and all the vegetation seeds in it. They'll stockpile that, and then they'll come out and they'll dump a load maybe 2 to 3 inches thick in the bottom of the pool, so that right away there's some a good opportunity to have the biota and the flora take off. We had a project in Merced which we finished in October, and in February the next February, we had the right vegetation and the fairy shrimp going. And the whole reason this is going on is because of some endangered species, and I'll show you one in a little bit. So they spread this out. Unfortunately, you can't be there at all times 100% of the time, and sometimes they undercut and they pile too much seed source on. So instead of being on the clay pan, you have 12 to 15 inches of loamy material or clayey material that's going to absorb, the water has to saturate before it will stop ponding, and they don't function very well. So this is a picture showing what the landscape looked like prior to as a pasture. This is the slope across this axis, and this is the slope across this axis right here. And after construction, to give a mound, inner mound natural landscape right here. This is what it looked like. And on this transect, that's what it looked like. So we really changed the landscape to more or less replicate what a natural mound, inner mound landscape looked like. I thought that was fun. Here's another picture showing kind of an oblique way. The red are the deepest or the thickest fills where we piled material from the excavation, the cuts. These areas are filled materials right here. The green are the deepest cuts. And so here you can see there's they turned this there. Remember the one with the deep soil, the buried profile at the bottom? They made this one, instead of a pond, a seasonal wetland. And we did find this old channel, so they actually excavated down to the old channel, and it worked beautifully. It's a seasonal wetland now. They actually call that Cook's Canyon. It's about 6 to 7 feet deep, and it worked pretty nice. So you kind of do things on the fly sometimes. So here it shows all these cut areas, and then the areas, the uplands, that kind of now mimic a natural landscape. And I thought this was really unique. Let me show you some. This one right here, these are actual, honest, before the land development. If you come down here, this is what was in the field. This is the design, and this is post-construction. So you go here, go up here, and if you look at this and look at that, I think we did a pretty good job. Here's another one. This area right here, that's as it was before ruining it or building a house on it. This was the design, and if you go over here and look, here, this is the one, and that's the one. And this is a really nice one, too. This one is the actual one. Here's the design, and here it is right here. So if you look at this and this, we're pretty close. So it's not just building round holes out in the landscape. We're trying to replicate what they actually destroyed. If you look at this map, you'll see some areas that were designed, but there's no construction going on. So this one was, after digging the backhoe pit or finding out, it didn't have the right soil properties. And some of them, you'll see like right here, where to compensate for that, well, actually, I said, let's go out a little further. Or in areas like this, we changed it entirely. And this was the design, and we changed from here to here. So that was things working on the fly. And the results of this, does it work or not work? Well, here's one. It's holding water. We have plants. I'll show you some better examples of plants. This is a constructed vernal pool. This is a constructed vernal pool. And a lot of people say, oh, you can't do it. They don't work. And to show you a shrimp, this is the tadpole shrimp right here with a little tail on it. It's about as big as your thumb. The biggest ones are about as big as your thumb. There's California shrimp. I wish Sid was here. He could tell you more about this. There's another shrimp, maybe, do you know, Phil, called California shrimp, and it's only about half inch long, about an eighth of an inch wide, swims on its back with the little fingers, and you can hardly see it. It's almost translucent. But that's the whole reason we're doing that, is because of these endangered species. And there's, you go out in the landscape, and you make a rut because you was wet, and you drove out there, there'll be fairy shrimp with you doing nothing in it the next year. Anyway, they have to monitor these things for about 10 years, and these are gauges to determine the depth of water. These are, again, this is all was straight leveled landscape, and now it's a mound, inner mound type situation. This is some of the vegetation. This is coyote thistle. which is a, if you find that, you know you have a pretty wet condition. This is, I wanted to sit here because I know the yellow is gold fields, and I forget what the white is. It's popcorn flower.
And the purple is Downingia.
Yeah, and I got one of Downingia right here. So these are, what happens in the springtime, they often, as the, they have a unique characteristic that the plants adapt to certain drying conditions. And sometimes you can have three sets of colors in a pool. As the pool dries down, there will be concentric rings around the pool as the water dries down. And this is mostly gold fields, as this is. One of the things they have to really be careful of is that this was not seeded. This is just natural vegetation that came back from the pasture. And they you have to graze this pretty heavily, or you have to burn it in order to make sure that the pools, the floristic part of the pools are operating properly. And it doesn't hurt anything to do with the fairy shrimp. I had another talk where cows can eat these things, and in the feces, fairy shrimp will survive. Ducks will eat it. The fairy shrimp will survive in the feces. Cow hooves on automobiles that you drive through it, on the tire scraping, the fairy shrimp cyst will survive and dump off and propagate again. So you can hardly kill these things off. Anyway, thank you for listening to me. And the end of the rainbow is not a pot of gold, but it's a vernal pool. Thank you.
Can you address that problem? Would you just assume that you would get $9 a year?
Based on experience, we know that from natural, the soils that occur in the natural landscape, we're trying to replicate that. And you can't always predict, but we're about 90 or 95% where we know we have good soil properties like dense clay layers, durapans. It's pretty sure that we're going to have, and the ones I've done now, well, I have 700-800 vernal pools I've helped construct. And so there, you can't always predict what the landscape is going to do, but we're pretty close.
Think you could build those things on upland ridges, and like in North Carolina we have the Triassic Basin. Either have those same vertisols or similar vertisols.
We've built these on slopes of about 15%, but you have to, in fact, I showed you a picture of one. We actually had to, no berm on the uphill side, and we built a berm on the downhill side, and we really compacted that berm with a sheep's foot roller, and they wanted to scrape off and smooth the dimples that left. I said, don't do that. That's a good seed source, and leave those dimples there. And one of the pictures was the good vernal pool, which I showed you, which was on about 10% slope, maybe 10 or 15, about 10% slope. But you get too much, and then it's the you can't. It's like a terrace, you know. You can't build because the depth of the pool and the berm will have to get higher and higher in order to get a wide enough pond area. Actually, what they're looking for is the area in mitigating the area of ponded surface. So if you when you squeeze on the steeper the slope, you squeeze the pond area down.
Are you finding with the whether you're grading these sites that by creating subtle high spots between them, that's the catchment area that is redirecting the water over to those pools? Or are you finding that just by excavation, you're exposing the groundwater?
It replicates more or less the natural landscape. You have to saturate the upland, though in studies that show that you can get filling just from rainfall into the pool area itself. But you still have to, the upland area will saturate and lateral flow into the pool. And you need normally about 5 5 to 7 inches of rain before you start filling. And it all depends. You can get a really good rain and no rain for a month. You need distribution as well as intent or amount. So it depends. And in the last several years, 3 or 4 years, there's been a drought. So the Corps of Engineers and EPA says they're not functioning like they should. Well, they're monitoring natural ones, and they weren't functioning either. So
I guess, you know, going back to a diagram that you had towards the beginning of your talk, where you're showing you're excavating not only the topsoil, but into the subsoil, which is the argilla layer. And so...
Well, we try not to, but...
You try not to get it into the argilla?
Right, we try not to get it into the clay pan, the argillic horizon, because that's where we want... That's the limiting layer. And that's good sealing material beside restricting
right.
material.
I guess I was thinking that, you know, if you excavated only 2 inches or 3 inches into that argilla layer, what you would have is lateral movement across the top of that argilla in the uplands.
Right.
And it would want to stay in that pocket that you created. And so, you know, as the water levels recede, water still migrates over towards that depression. But you're finding that even... you don't have to excavate that far into the argilla.
No.
Terry, you don't design these with any design consideration for a downslope invert point on the pond so that it would overflow. You don't do anything to make sure it doesn't fill up too much.
They have a spillway design,
okay.
And some one of the complaints that this company just had from the Corps and EPA with another outfit that spent tens of thousands of dollars to fry us, but anyway, they questioned the depth of the pool. Well, I've read literature that some pools are 2 to 3 feet thick, and so, but we try to maintain that if it gets to be about a foot, that it's going to spill somewhere, or in fact, we'll even create, if it's too much, we'll even create make a cut to make it spill. And of course, it's not 100% perfect. Some of them are tilted a little bit, and which is the way it goes in nature too. So some areas may be 2 inches and some areas may be. They try to put those monitoring bricks at the deepest, I go around with a laser level and pick the deepest spot, and that's where the deepest point will be. And that's where they try to put that brick.
What was that? Annual rainfall at your site?
What's that?
Annual rainfall at your site?
It's the average, and there's no average in the Mediterranean climate here in the valley, in Sacramento Valley. But it ranges from, say, 16 to maybe about 20 inches.
Mm-hmm. That rainfall is all from pretty much November through March.
Right.
And so you stay wet just long enough into the growing season to make the
yeah. The fairy shrimp, they form a little BB-sized cyst during the dormant season.
And they can last forever.
They've recovered stuff that's been buried for 20 to 50 years. But their life cycle will be that they will pretty much pop out of those cysts after about 3 weeks, 4 weeks of standing water, be around for 4 weeks, and then the female pretty much just dies, and the cyst in her sac just drop to the bottom of the pool, unless she gets eaten, and then those cysts end up going with the animal. So they really don't have to be persistent for real long. And California is known for having these drought years, where sometimes the pools don't even fill up at all. And I think one of the critical things to the fairy shrimp is if the water in the pools warms up too much, too fast, then it can be toxic. So in other words, if it's a drought year, some of the fairy shrimp will hatch, but if it warms up too fast, they may actually die. They're very temperature sensitive. So you don't expect to find many of those fairy shrimp after about March most years.
I have to plead ignorance. I'm not familiar with the history of vernal pools. I don't know how they meet the nexus criteria, again, we can be regulated in the first place.
It's a state criteria.
Well, there was a...
Oh, Fish and Wildlife.
UC Davis, guy, more or less erroneously, said that there was only 10% of the vernal pools left in California, in the valley, and without pretty good scientific background information, the environmentalist audit, they got approved as an endangered species, and it's 400 out of 4 million acres. He said there